Greetings and salivations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this November 2009 installment of Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening, Jim Campanella. Yes, you did hear right. I said salivations. Forgive me for my bad joke, but the first story of the night is about the sense of taste. So I figured salivations fit. You would think that the sense of taste is one of those things that we pretty much have a handle on. I mean, obviously people have been tasting things for thousands of years. That's why it came as a bit of a surprise in the early 1900s when a new taste was discovered. It goes by the name of umami because it was discovered by a Japanese researcher. In case you've never heard of it before, it's the ability to taste savory, meaty flavors like monosodium glutamate or the flavor of soy sauce, that sort of strong, savory flavor in soy sauce. That was about 100 years ago. Well, a new flavor has been now discovered. Hold on to your hats. It's carbonation. Yes, we can actually taste carbon dioxide in our drinks. Dr. Charles Zucker of Columbia University and his research group reported in October in the journal Science that the sour-tasting cells in humans can also detect carbonation. And it's not the bubbles themselves that are being detected, as many scientists suggested before the study. Zucker found that bubbly drinks still taste distinctly carbonated even when they're drunk in a pressure chamber where the bubbles don't actually burst. The researchers measured nerve activity in mouse taste cells. When the rodents were given carbon dioxide and club soda, or straight gaseous CO2, their taste cells responded robustly to the CO2. Zucker then genetically engineered the mice to be missing one of the five kinds of taste cells: sweet, salty, umami, bitter, and sour. It was found that the mice missing sweet, salty, umami, and bitter receptors still fired in response to carbon dioxide. It was only in the mice without the sour receptor that no firing occurred. And that pinpointed the role of the sour-tasting taste cells in the process. Well, the obvious question is why? Why have we evolved the ability to taste bubbles of Coca-Cola and champagne? This is presumably not a marketing ploy on either the part of aliens or Mother Nature. Zucker suggests, quote, "In the bigger picture, tasting carbonation may have allowed animals to sense CO2 produced in foods that had fermented or gone bad, akin to how bitter-sensing taste cells can warn of potential toxicity," unquote. Well, the next story I find kind of interesting because my 18-month-old son still has stubbornly decided not to talk. He understands fine and follows directions and even has a small number of sign language signs that he uses that he learned in daycare. And he babbles, so his vocal cords are okay. He has just decided that he has nothing to say, probably because we understand him just fine enough. So the story concerns the earliest aspects of human language acquisition. How early do you think that kids start to learn your language? 2 months old? 6 months old? 12? How about this? How about they start to learn within 2 to 5 days after birth? Kathleen Wermke of the University of Würzburg in Germany and her colleagues published a paper in the November 5th issue of Current Biology that has evidence that babies actually begin to acquire basic language skills just a few days after birth. Dr. Wermke reported that by 2 to 5 days of age, infants' cries bear the, quote, tonal signature of their parents' native tongue, a sign that language learning has already begun. Native language speakers use melodic patterns and pitch shifts to give their words and phrases emotional meaning. Changes in pitch and rhythm, for example, can indicate anger. During the first few days of life, babies can hear what their mothers or nearby adults are saying, providing exposure to melodies that are peculiar to a specific language. Well, Wermke proposes that newborns can actually recreate those familiar patterns, and at least some of their crying. Wermke says, quote, "Our data support the idea that human infants' crying is important for seeding language development. Melody lies at the roots of both the development of spoken language and music," unquote. Dr. Wermke and her colleagues studied 60 newborns, 30 born to French families, and 30 born to German. The researchers recorded 2,500 cries as mothers were changing babies' diapers, readying the babies for feeding, or otherwise just interacting with the children. Acoustic measurements allowed the researchers to identify 1,254 cries, In this case, a cry is a vocalization produced in a single breath. That's how they actually defined it. And these cries contained clear rising and falling arcs that were suitable for detailed analysis. The cries of German newborns tended to start out high-pitched and then move increasingly to lower pitches, whereas French newborns started out low-pitched and then moved to higher pitches. And this is actually comparable to the high-to-low and low-to-high intonation patterns that characterize words and phrases by fluent speakers of German and French. And listen to this. Wermke put it online. You see the point now. Getting back to my son, it's interesting that despite these results, a related scientific debate concerns whether parents' native language influences how babies babble during the first year of life. Oddly enough, it's generally regarded that babies babbling are a universal set of sounds, largely immune to cultural or linguistic influences. This is strange because most researchers consider babbling a kind of human metalanguage. Now, I don't entirely follow the reasoning here that baby cries are affected by native language, but their babbling is not. But then again, I'm not a medical anthropologist or a linguist. Just to get away from biology for a second, let's look at astronomy. First, a story from our own solar system, which smacks of science fiction, and it is just plain cool. Dr. Richard Greenberg of the University of Arizona reported at the October 9th annual meeting of the American Astronomical Society that he hypothesizes that Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter, has about 100 times more oxygen in its ocean than previous models indicated, enough to support respiration of about 3 million tons of Terran fish, or their Europan equivalent. Researchers who've been hunting for signs of life beyond Earth have long suggested that Europa, because of its icy surface and the fact that it has no craters in its terrain, they've suggested that the moon contains a vast ocean buried under that ice. Greenberg calculated that oxygen generated by ions striking water molecules on the moon's surface would take 1 to 2 billion years to begin seeping into the ocean and oxygenating it. That is enough time for life to evolve, according to many researchers, including Greenberg. I mean, we don't often think about this, but oxygen is actually quite poisonous to life, if that life has not evolved slowly with it. Oxygen breaks down into radicals, which in turn can damage protein, DNA, or other molecules which are essential to life. Even on Earth, we have anaerobic bacteria that will die quickly if exposed to oxygen because they simply do not have the enzymes necessary to degrade those nasty radicals. If oxygen on Europa had been immediately released into the ocean, it would have destroyed fledgling life, which would never have had a chance to develop at all. Greenberg suggested that over a period of about 50 million years, a layer of ice 300 meters thick slowly rose from below and eventually covered the moon's surface and erased the old craters. As a result of this facelift, Europa's oxygenated layer grew increasingly thick until after about 1 to 2 billion years, the entire ice layer was oxygen-rich. At that point, ice melting at the bottom of the frozen layer began delivering oxygen into the proposed buried ocean at a faster rate than previously estimated, resulting in about 100 times more oxygen in the ocean. And seriously, when I read all this, all I can think about was that story, Frozen Sky, by Jeff Carlson, that was presented in Oral Delights number 35. Seriously, it's an awesome story. Check it out. You'll understand what I mean if you haven't heard the story. Okay, this next story is an update. We've been following over the last year or so the search for exoplanets. If you don't remember, the term exoplanet refers to a planet which is outside our solar system. Over the last year or so, I've reported smaller and smaller exoplanets being discovered. Many of the planets have been just a few times bigger than the Earth, but almost all of them have not been terrestrial-type planets with a hard core. Dr. Didier Queloz and his colleagues at the Geneva Observatory have reported in the November issue of the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics that they finally have found something that is very close to Earth size and rocky. Queloz's planet is about 500 light years from Earth and closely orbits its parent star, but it's much too hot to support life. It's about 2,000 degrees Celsius on its sunny side. However, The diameter and newly determined mass of the planet, dubbed Korot 7b, indicate that the planet has a bulk composition very similar to Earth's. That is, this new planet likely has a silicate mantle and iron core. And that is, yes, just like our good old home sweet home here. The mass measurement of the planet, in combination with the diameter, reveals that it has an average density of about 5.5 grams per cubic centimeter. Believe it or not, that's almost identical to Earth. Now, this is the smallest extrasolar planet yet known, with a diameter of about 1.8 times that of Earth. The researchers were able to pin down the size of the planet because the orb periodically passes in front of its parent star, as seen from the Earth, and it blocks out a tiny amount of sunlight. Astronomers are seriously excited about this because they think that it's only the beginning. More and smaller planets are on the way, they predict, and they will look even more like the Earth, perhaps even with water. On whether they actually find these planets, only time will tell. I mean, there are certainly researchers out there who still believe that our planet is unique, but statistically, it just doesn't seem very likely. Okay, the listener question of the month. Listener question of the month comes from Jason Derry, who has two questions, and neither of them are part of my expertise. Remember that as you listen to me prattle here. Question number one, why can't we produce clean energy from burning hydrogen electrolyzed from water? And the answer is, of course we can. Hydrogen can be used for fuel, and there are actually quite a number of vehicles, almost entirely for industrial purposes, mind you, that run on hydrogen. Heck, Shell Oil is so confident that hydrogen vehicles will become more popular, they actually opened the first free hydrogen pumping station in New York last February. Of course, it's easy to make something free when you're pretty confident that there are maybe four vehicles in the whole town who'll use it. Honda actually has sold a couple of hundred Clarities in the U.S. A Clarity is a hydrogen fuel-based car, and probably if you haven't heard of it, it's not a surprise. It's supposed to be an excellent vehicle, and it burns hydrogen from its tank to run the engine. The other type of vehicle that you may be thinking of, or you may have heard of, is called a fuel cell car. Now, a fuel cell does exactly what you described. It takes water, breaks it down into hydrogen and oxygen, and then uses the hydrogen for fuel. Unfortunately, given the prohibitive cost of a fuel cell vehicle, they are custom made, not mass produced. No automaker is going to be selling them to the public for the next 10 or 15 years. And many energy companies remain skeptical of the long-term prospects for hydrogen, arguing, among other things, that even when government help, the infrastructure costs, the setup costs, so that everybody would have access to hydrogen, they would just be enormous. Now, as far as using hydrogen for large-scale energy production, it's just impractical right now. Remember, it takes energy to make hydrogen. You have to put too much energy in to make the hydrogen to make it a viable alternative energy source on a large scale. So be patient. Your hydrogen car is coming. It just may be a few years yet. Now, question number two, whatever happened to cold fusion from the 1980s? Well, that answer is pretty easy. Nothing. And that's the problem. On March 23rd, 1989, Fleischmann and Pons claimed that they had achieved nuclear fusion in a jar of water at room temperature. Their claim was met with disbelief and then excitement. If cold fusion was possible, it could certainly solve the energy crisis. And in the following weeks, physicists from the best research centers in the world sought to replicate Pons and Fleischmann's experiment, and they failed miserably. On May 3, 1989, while Pons was in Washington waiting to meet with then-President Bush's advisors, the American Physical Society concluded that every possible variant of the Pons-Fleischmann experiments had been tried without any success. They concluded that the claim of cold fusion was invalid. Mind you, despite the overwhelming evidence that suggests that cold fusion cannot be achieved, given the experimental setup of Pons and Fleischmann, there are still lots of, well, fringe scientists, including a professor emeritus of physics from my own university, who insist it is possible. If you want an excellent text to read about the history of cold fusion, I suggest reading Bad Science, The Short Life and Weird Times of Cold Fusion by Gary Taubes. It's published out of Random House. I recommend it highly if you want to know the details about the entire sordid affair. Okay, now seriously, I was not going to do an ant story this month. I swear, I thought I had pretty much mined out that particular vein of interest. But I came across this story completely by accident, and I thought it was so interesting I had to pass it along. The story is a bit different than what I've been relating about ants over the last several months. This is less to do with their physiology and communication, and more to do with their sheer annoying nature. We think that ants are tiny and can have little effect on big animals, especially animals like birds, who should come into contact with ants rarely. But such is not always the case. Ecologist Dr. Dennis O'Dowd of Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, reported in the September 15th issue of the journal Biology Letters on a species of ant that is apparently annoying to a large range of animals. You've probably heard of the red fire ant that's found in South and Central America and now in Southern North America. It's a nasty species that makes large nests, has a painful sting, and is quite aggressive. It's legendary for being just plain malevolent. And believe it or not, there are actually species of ants that are even more aggressive and mean. Dr. O'Dowd reports on the yellow crazy ant, an aggressive, invasive ant that even drives birds nuts. It's called the yellow crazy ant because it scurries around insanely, hence crazy ant. O'Dowd found that on Christmas Island, an Australian territory in the Indian Ocean, hordes of yellow crazy ants pester birds that try to land on plants and eat. They found that if the ants were kept off plant stems in the ant-invaded zones, that more than doubled the chances that a fruit would actually be bitten by a bird. The conclusion, these crazy ants were keeping the birds from eating. On Christmas Island, the ants have caused so many changes to the ecology that O'Dowd and Dr. Peter Green have declared an invasional meltdown of the original ecosystem. Ants probably got onto the island about 100 years ago, but they've really boomed since the 1990s. Super colonies now cover swaths of the island in such density that the ants, in a feeding frenzy, can clear the forest of its once important crab species. They swarm over the crabs, they bite them, they spray the poor things with formic acid. And the ants climb onto the birds, too. In ant-dense zones, O'Dowd sees birds stomp and ruffle their feathers as if maddened by crawling ants. To see if this nuisance affects the bird feeding, the authors set out an array of artificial fruits made from non-toxic modeling clay. In forests not yet invaded by ants, the fruit showed more than twice as many peck marks by the birds as fake fruits in the ant zones. The really amazing thing about these observations is that something so small can affect vertebrate animals so directly and mess with the ecosystem so completely. The authors are quite worried that these and other aggressive species are moving beyond their tropical venues. O'Dowd says, quote, "People have to wake up to what invasive ants are doing to world ecosystems. These disruptive ants are moving far and wide. Everyone has to realize how important ants are," unquote. All right, enough on that subject. Here is a bisphenol A update from last month. You may remember that I discussed BPA as being a hormonal analog found in plastics that causes all sorts of developmental problems. Dr. Bruce Lamphere of Simon Fraser University reports that BPA exposure in the womb during development can affect both boys and girls. In utero exposure makes girls more aggressive and boys become more withdrawn and anxious. Now that's a serious worry, but it's not really a surprise. What is a surprise is that they found a new source of BPA exposure: credit card and store receipts. It turns out that carbonless copy paper works by coating a powdery layer of BPA onto one side of a piece of paper, along with an invisible ink. Later, when you apply pressure or heat, the BPA and the ink merge together and you get color. They found that the average cash register receipt that's out there and uses the BPA technology has about 60 to 100 milligrams of free BPA. By free, a physiologist would mean that that's not bound into a polymer, like the BPA in polycarbonate plastics. It's just individual molecules loose and ready for uptake. As such, when it comes to BPA in the urban environment, the biggest exposures may well be cash register receipts. Once on the fingers, the BPA can be transferred to foods or to other people, or like estrogen in controlled-release patches, it may be that BPA might similarly enter the skin directly. Great. Now I can't drink anything out of plastic and I have to refrain from touching receipts? This is just looking better and better. And like I pointed out last month, this is a chemical that we know about. You figure that there must be a whole panoply of chemicals that are out there that are affecting us without our knowledge. Oh, by the way, just to put this into perspective, plastic bottles, which I talked about last month, they release nanogram quantities of BPA, not milligrams. Now, what do you think is more dangerous? Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care, stay away from receipts and crazy yellow ants, and I hope I have inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.